President and CEO, Helen Keller International, Kathy Spahn.
Thanks very much. I feel doubly fortunate that I get to wear the two hats for this session. I'd love to ask those of you in back to move up because it feels kind of lonely up front here. And then I'd like to jump right into the commitments and ask actually a very special friend of Helen Keller International's, Mark Van Ameringen, Executive Director of the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, otherwise known as GAIN, and Dr. Tanuja Rastogi, Special Advisor on Nutrition to the Executive Director of the UN World Food Program, Josette Sheeran. Their commitment is to reduce anemia among nutritionally vulnerable Egyptians. Working with the Egyptian Ministry of Social Solidarity and the World Food Program, GAIN has committed to address iron deficiency in Egypt by fortifying the wheat flour that's used to produce bolati bread with iron and folic acid. They'll be working with over 140 flour mills scattered throughout Egypt and will implement social marketing and advocacy so that everyone knows the value toward good nutrition of the flour. In all, the commitment is expected to reduce the prevalence of anemia by 28% over 3 years, reaching 50 million people, about half of whom are women and children. It's a wonderful commitment. Now I'd like to ask Felicia Mary Knoll, who is the director of the Tomatelo a Pecho program, which means take it to heart, and it's for breast cancer in Latin America and the Caribbean. This is a commitment to increase awareness among women, healthcare providers, and policymakers about the challenge of breast cancer in Latin America and the Caribbean. Working with multiple partners, Felicia, who herself is a breast cancer patient, has committed to organize a program to advocate for the importance of early detection in the fight against breast cancer, and also to provide training on breast health with a special focus on breast clinical examination for primary providers and outreach workers, including medical students, nurses, and midwives, and also to promote institutional capacity building and training. And over the span of 2 years, this commitment will raise awareness among millions and millions of women throughout the region, which will do a lot to prevent deaths from breast cancer. It's wonderful. And then I'd like to invite Kurt Welling, the President and CEO of America Cares, and Gary Cohen, the Executive Vice President of BD, for a commitment promoting the health and safety of medical professionals in Tanzania. America Cares, BD, along with Merck, the University of Virginia, and Healthcare Without Harm are partnering together for a healthcare worker safety program in Tanzania. And through this commitment, they will provide training to doctors, nurses, and laboratory technicians at the Bugando Medical Center on the universal basic precautions and technical use of specialized medical commodities. They will be providing safety-engineered medical supplies, barrier garments, and things including safe injection devices, gloves, and masks, and also immunization and post-exposure prophylaxis for hepatitis B, tetanus, and treatment for hepatitis C for all employees in need, as well as technical support for hazardous waste disposal for healthcare products such as syringes. So a part of our healthcare system that's often neglected and is critically important.
To not only serve as the moderator but and the commitment announcer, but we thought it was unreasonable to ask her to announce her own commitment. So as a working group chair, I want to recognize Kathy who, on behalf of Helen Keller International, has developed an innovative, comprehensive nutrition strategy to address maternal and child nutrition issues, including garden technical training programs, micronutrient and maternal nutrition support, and state-of-the-art behavior change models for breastfeeding. Additionally, the HKI Homestead Food Production Plus commitment uses an agricultural platform to encourage health changes and enhance maternal nutrition, improving on its initial idea of traditional homestead food production, including a scale-up of its monitoring and evaluation in two districts in the western region of Nepal. HKI anticipates reaching a total population of 860,000 community members, including approximately 200,000 women of reproductive age and 41,000 children under the age of two. So please join me in congratulating Kathy for this fantastic event. And Anna Langer, I ask you to rise as well. I want to recognize you, Anna Langer, from Engender Health, who's made a commitment to reduce maternal mortality resulting from preeclampsia and eclampsia, which is one of the leading causes of maternal deaths. This commitment will increase access to magnesium sulfate, an effective and inexpensive but underutilized treatment. Through this commitment, an estimated 6,000 women living in India, Mexico, and Nigeria will receive life-saving treatment, health providers, and systems will be strengthened, health policies will be revised, and ultimately, women's lives will be saved. So please join me in giving a big round of congratulations for all of our commitments.
And our panelists for today, President, Human Nutrition and Health, DSM Nutritional Products Limited, Maurizio Adade. Managing Director and CEO, Britannia Industries Limited, Vinita Bali. And Director, Indonesian Breastfeeding Center, Utami Rusli.
I think what we've been hearing a lot about the last few days is how everything we're here to discuss is interconnected. Climate, poverty, education. But I'm really thrilled to see that there is also a special focus on nutrition and delighted to have this opportunity with this wonderful panel who I've gotten to know over the last day or two. Good nutrition is essential for child survival, and I actually want to start with a quote from a World Bank report that came out a couple of years ago, and it may be a statistic that many of you are already familiar with. Poor nutrition is implicated in more than half of all child deaths worldwide, which is a proportion unmatched by any infectious disease since the Black Death. Approximately 60% of children who die of diseases like malaria, pneumonia, diarrhea might not have died if they'd been well-nourished, but the fact is their immune systems are so broken down because they're malnourished that they can't fight off these diseases. For the children who do survive, their school performance often suffers, and their physical work capacity is diminished, which leads to poverty, which leads to more malnutrition. The tough challenge here is that the window of opportunity to improve nutrition is very short. It is from conception to 2 years of age. It is a critical period of growth that determines the future well-being, the health, and the intellectual potential of a child. Beyond that point, beyond 24 months of age, the damage caused by malnutrition to physical capacity and mental capacity is irreversible. Thus, the health of the mother is critical, and the health of the woman pre-motherhood. So it's very important to target programs to women of reproductive age, which in many of the countries in the developing world means adolescence. That is a key step to breaking an intergenerational cycle of malnutrition, because malnourished women give birth to malnourished babies who grow into malnourished teenagers who become malnourished mothers who have malnourished children. The solutions aren't completely simple, because access to food is not a guarantee of good nutrition. Not all food in a household gets into the mouths of those who need it. Often the food will go to the men first, not the children, and not the pregnant women in the household. And also, women sometimes lack education about what is the optimal nutrition for their young children, and will often pass on traditional practices of feeding that may not be helpful and, in the worst cases, are harmful. To complicate this further, not all food is created equally. You can have plenty to eat, plenty of calories, that is, and still be malnourished. You need vitamin A, iron, zinc, and other vitamins and minerals that are critical to healthy growth, both of the body and of the mind. The world food price crisis, which we've been hearing about these last 2 days, is going to result in even higher levels of malnutrition across the world. And as prices increase, food consumption is going to decrease. Families are going to decrease the diversity of what they eat. They're going to go to less expensive foods like rice that may have calories but doesn't have nutrients. They'll give up animal foods first, then vegetables. They'll resort to smaller portions, to less frequent meals, and even to going hungry as a way to cope. The good news is there are tested cost-effective solutions, and this panel certainly knows about them. Early and exclusive breastfeeding, which is perhaps the single most effective action, supplementation with vitamin A and zinc, fortification of staple foods, and development of nutrient-dense complementary foods that can be fed to children from the age of 6 months on. The good thing about all of these interventions is they have a phenomenal cost-to-benefit ratio. So what's getting in the way? We know what to do. Where it seems to break down is how to do it. How do we deliver these interventions? Another thing that gets in the way is it's going to take everybody working together, governments, the private sector, the NGOs, and we all have a tendency to work in silos rather than partner. So I'm going to start with some questions for our panelists to delve into this deeper, and I encourage you, as you hear the panelists' responses, if you have questions you want asked of the panelists, to write them down and hand them to your table facilitator so that we can ask them when we reconvene. I'm going to start with breastfeeding, since that is a top intervention. We know that improved breastfeeding can save the lives of millions of infants and young children, but it's not that simple. I'm going to start with Utami and ask, what are the factors in optimal breastfeeding? And also, what are the risks if a mother does not breastfeed?
Okay. Maybe we better start with what actually exclusive breastfeeding and what is actually initiation of breastfeeding? Because I come from Indonesia. In my country, we just realize now that we are not very optimal early initiation. The early initiation, you know, is actually now is like giving the baby a chance to initiate breastfeeding by himself, and as soon as the baby born, by putting the baby skin to skin to the mother for at least 1 hour, or after the first feeding finished. That we just realize now that that's actually the early initiation of breastfeeding. Let the baby breastfed by themselves. And of course, exclusive breastfeeding is you give nothing else but breastfeeding for at least 6 months.
And you should underscore that, please.
Yes. nothing at all. And of course, there's a lot of risk, especially in my country. I don't think we cannot afford not to go back to breastfeeding. Take, for instance, exclusive and early initiation and exclusive breastfeeding can help to eradicate the poverty. For instance, the cost of a formula in our country for baby born in 1 year in our country, it costs $1.65 billion. Because 5 million babies born in my country. And if a family earn, let's say, $50, $50 more or less, then for 6 months, they have to spend more than 100% of the income. The income will be $325, and the cost of the formula is $335. This does not include the health-related costs, because we know now that formula babies are sick more often. For instance, incident of gastroenteritis infection was 47% higher, and 16.7 times likely to be diagnosed pneumonia, and 3 times more the infection more than 3 times higher admitted to the hospital. And the new study shown that there are a significant higher risk of pediatric cancer, such as lymphocytic leukemia, lymphoma maligna, and Hodgkin. Guisa in Journal of Pediatrics 2005, stated that in your county, USA, approximately your country spends $1.4 billion U.S. dollar annually to treat children leukemia. We cannot afford that. And there are risk of asthmatic attack 40-80% more. And there's a lot less long that. And but more than that, it's an effective intervention to reduce underweight, stunting, and micronutrient deficiency. Because from The Lancet, the series of maternal and child undernutrition, January 2008, it seemed like breastfeeding counseling, approximately family complementary food, and vitamin A and zinc, they have the greatest potential to eradicate or at least minimize the malnutrition. And
I think if we can, let's take it from there, because that's some pretty powerful evidence, some pretty frightening statistics about what happens if a mom doesn't breastfeed. And we'll come back to breastfeeding later in the panel. But as you've heard Utami say, it's exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months of life. After that 6 months, there's a whole new generation of micronutrient-fortified complementary foods that can be fed along with breast milk. But then if we look back to days of infant nutrition and the private sector getting involved in this, there's been a lot of distrust between the public sector and the private sector and the profit motive. What's more important, improving human nutrition or increasing profits, doing good or doing well? So, Mauricio, if I can put you on the spot and ask how you at DSM react to criticisms that promotion of micronutrient-fortified food products is a marketing ploy on the part of your companies to increase market share and profits, and that you really don't care about human nutrition. And how do you balance doing well with doing good?
Thank you. I really feel on spot. I'll start saying that it's impossible to succeed in business in a society that fails. The food industry and the micronutrient industry is here to serve and to find solutions for micronutrient deficiency that are essential elements in childhood, but also for the mothers. It's correct that these companies have profit. They are profitable companies. But the major question is how these profits are used in order to develop more and better technologies to make the micronutrients that are essential accessible for the needy population. And I think this is where a very conscious decision and a very ethical companies are looking into and working in this direction. In bringing new technologies that make the micronutrients more available, but also more stable in the different applications. And I think there are many examples where the industry have shown commitment in bringing solutions to the children and also for different sides of the population. And I can mention some of them, like sugar fortification with vitamin A that has eradicate night blindness in countries like Central America and Guatemala, and more recently also in Africa. So the balance between being responsible business and acting in the direction of sustaining the solution of micronutrient deficiency is very fine. But I truly believe that with correct ethics in business, there is no contradiction between being profitable and having sustainable solution for the needy population.
Thanks. And I think certainly the commitment from GAIN that we announced earlier today is another example of that. So I've picked a bit on public health and on the corporate sector. I want to turn now to the world food price crisis and what that's going to do to malnutrition and hunger in the world. And ask Vinita, if you were a government planner in a developing country with unlimited power, what would you do to help mitigate what is going to be the devastating impact of this food price crisis?
I think I particularly like the unlimited power bit. You know, I think where governments can certainly step in and play a big role is in the entire area of implementation of programs. I come from India, where there are very large governmental programs, and it's not for want of ideas on how to tackle the situation, but it is for want of the right implementation and the right governance that a lot of the benefits don't actually reach the people they're most created for or meant to reach. So I actually would do three very specific things. One, of course, is induce a greater sense of implementation, accountability, and governance in the sense of having metrics that you track along the way. The second thing I would do is to attack this as a primary concern. And I think there are enough examples where the government has brought its entire machinery to the fore, where the problems have actually been eradicated. I talk of, polio, which was a big problem in India, is virtually being eradicated. Immunization is another good example. And, between yesterday and today, we've heard enough about what the governments can do if they were to really galvanize their resources. And I think the third thing really would be in terms of regulatory practices. Mauricio just talked about examples of what happens when you fortify sugar with vitamin A. Again, in several countries, diseases, or the deficiencies that come from lack of iodine as a result of iodized salt have literally vanished. So I do believe that the government has a very critical and a very important role to play because of the masses of people the government impacts. And I think it was mentioned earlier, it's more a matter of political will than the lack of resources. And when the political will is there, irrespective of what country we are talking about, and I happen to have lived in several countries in Africa, I've worked in Latin America, I come from India, so I know a little bit about the developing world. And I think there are enough examples from each of these countries to prove that where there is political will and where there is the right implementation and governance, the problem can be tackled quite decisively.
It's nice to see you didn't go wild with power. I think we would all vote for you for office. I want to come back to breastfeeding and the responsibility of the corporate sector, because particularly in Asia now, hundreds of thousands of women are working in factories to earn a living. And what happens when they have babies if they are to practice optimal breastfeeding, meaning exclusive breastfeeding for their first 6 months of life? If they go to the factory, do they leave their baby at home, who will then be suboptimally fed? Or do they try to bring their baby to the workplace? So, Tommy, I'm going to turn back to you and say, what can factory owners do realistically, not in a dream world, what can factory owners do to improve the possibility for mothers to breastfeed?
No, maybe before that, maybe we better talk about what the risk of mother not to breastfeed. You know, we just heard about breast cancer. 25% to 30% increased breast cancer in women with not breastfeeding. Guizer, I think 2005, even they have a study that if you breastfed a baby, a girl, that exclusive up until 6 months and then 2 years, the baby itself, before she is breastfed, the risk of breast cancer will decrease 12%. Not mentioning it, cancer of ovarian, endometrial cancer. So actually it's not fair. There's a right to be a working woman, but there's a right working woman to, right to be a mother. So, actually, there is what they call mother-baby friendly workplace. where actually it depends on how the workplace is. If the mother lives outside, far away from the factory, of course, the most sensible thing is give them time twice 50 minutes to express their breast milk, and then give place where you can put the breast milk, take for instance a freezer or an ice cup, because it's 24 hours there. And if the baby, if the mother's house is around the factory, just make a crash. And it will have a win-win solution for the company too, because then you don't have to pay for the mother when mother's sick or the baby's sick. So it's just that a lot of factory or company did not understand totally what actually will be, you know, the advantage for the company. I think they have the right to breastfeed.
Thanks very much. I want to turn back now to private sector involvement. And when we talk about micronutrient fortified foods, I think it's natural that we all think about supply. Is there enough of those foods around? But I actually want to turn the question around and ask Mauricio, if supply were sufficiently scaled up, if that was not an issue, is there sufficient demand for these products? Is the public primed to purchase them? At what price point can they afford them?
Let me start with the cost of fortification. I think there is normally this question about what is the cost of fortification. As an average, for a staple food to be fortified with the correct micronutrients, the additional cost is less than 1% of the total cost. So this is a very important data when you think about the cost effectiveness of these programs that have been more than proven, including the World Bank, with economical models. So I think from the perspective of cost effectiveness of food fortification, it has more than been proven that is efficacious. Now, coming to the situation of demand, one of the most important things when you talk about food fortification is not changing or trying to avoid as much as possible the habits of the different population. If we try to introduce different foods, if you try to introduce the same food with different color, with different taste, this is something that is not accepted and normally has been proven that it's not successful if you try to engage in this kind of programs. So in the supply demand, one of the most important factors is that from the technological point of view, and the technology most of the case is available, is to add the micronutrients that are needed in without changing the habits. And in doing this, the normal food pattern that is taken for the different population is not changed, and then the effect is expected in the supplementation and the fortification with the micronutrients is achieved.
So then rather than if you build it, they will come, it's the theory that you're not building anything new. You're just building it into the fabric of what already exists.
The less that is needed in order to change the habits, and this is valid for all the population around the world, the more effective it is when you add micronutrients.
Thanks. Let's now go to that purchasing point, and Vinita, take it a step further. If we're talking about reaching children and families of the lowest socioeconomic levels, you could consider two approaches, a cross-subsidization approach where there is a higher-end product that's charged at a higher price to subsidize lower costs for people who can't afford it, or you could forget a commercial model at all and say this is a public sector responsibility. Which would you advocate, and what do you see as the unique challenges to either approach?
I would actually go with the first approach for a very, very simple reason, and that is that I think the private sector owes it to the communities and the societies that the private sector is operating in to, and I don't want to use cliched terms to give back, but what I also am very convinced about is that there are enough models out there where you don't have to sacrifice the interest of profit for doing the right thing. So what do I mean by that? Let me tell you not an example. This is something that we've actually done in a small way in the company that I work with. We make cookies and biscuits and bread and so on. And I think to the point Mauricio made, we've actually seen our sales go up in double digits, and I'm talking about between 15 and 20% once we've fortified the products that we sell with micronutrients and actually communicated the benefit of that to consumers. And the first steps in that direction we actually took together with Gain, and I know Mark is here. When Gain first entered India, we took some baby steps in terms of saying, gee whiz, if we were to fortify our biscuits and provide them as supplements to the school meal program, what would actually happen? And we created a partnership between Gain, a local NGO in India, and Britannia, where we supplied the fortified biscuits to the midday meal program. And I am truly glad to report that over a five-month period, we saw a 20% increase in the levels of hemoglobin of the kids who were actually consuming these biscuits. We then went a step further and said, if we had to fortify the biscuits that we sell to all consumers, what would it cost us? And we did the math, and to cut a long story short, we now have a credo in my company where we say that we're going to set aside 2% of our net sales value in terms of investing, by way of fortification, the entire range of products that we sell. And over the last 18 months, we've actually fortified 50% of our product range. And what we found is that when you communicate what you're doing effectively and make it relevant to consumers, and back to the point that was mentioned earlier, we haven't changed the taste profile of the biscuit. We've actually made it more affordable. We've made it more accessible. And therefore, we've made it more attractive. And what we find is that even amongst the low-income group in India, people are willing to pay for something they believe is good for them.
Mauricio, do you want to add anything to that?
I think this is a fantastic example, and I think there are so many other examples around the globe that I would like to share. Because it's for the companies themselves, one of the important points that was mentioned here about having the 2% dedicated for these kind of programs. This is one aspect. The other very important aspect is that the engagement of the employees in the company when you have these kinds of activities in the companies. As an example, we and our company have done a partnership with the World Food Program. In order to, number one, share the technological advances that we have and make the basket of food more nutritious, i.e. adding more micronutrients to it. This is one aspect. But another very important aspect is that we have a program with our own employees where they are invited to participate in the camps that the World Food Program have in Asia, in Africa, and in Latin America for a period of time, contributing with their knowledge in order to make these programs very successful. And this brings a lot of pride to the people that work for our company because they really understand that these kind of activities are very important for our world.
I think we've got some good examples of corporate enlightenment. Now, Utami, you are an advocate. You're not part of the private sector. If you had one message to give to the donor community, so not to the private sector, but to donors, funders, governments, what's your message?
Well, I just want to quote from Lancet, 1994. If a new vaccine that could prevent more than 1 million child death a year, cheap, safe, administered orally, and require no cold chain, become available, we would all invest in developing and promoting this vaccine. We already have breast milk, early initiation, exclusive breastfeeding, continue breastfeeding up until 2 years, can do all this and more. If all of us are successful in promoting and ensuring that every baby breastfed, we will protect and provide the very best for the generation to come. This world will be a healthier world and a better place to live. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And then Vinita and Mauricio, if you had a message to give to the NGO community, What would you want them to hear from either of you?
I would say that, you know, there are enough resources available out there between the private sector and the government agencies. And I think the most critical thing is to partner and collaborate in those areas where, you know, the core competencies of the NGO, the private sector, and the government can collectively work towards providing the best that is available to the people who need it the most. I think the NGOs play a very, very important role in terms of being a part of the local communities. But I think where the NGOs and the private sector can benefit is by working a lot more collaboratively and across a number of, you know, work around the areas more comprehensively. So nutrition is not a problem of nutrition. Nutrition is a problem of good habits, you know, clean and hygienic personal habits and so on and so forth. And that's where a group of NGOs coming together with the private sector could actually take the agenda a lot further than everybody trying to do it on their own.
So let's build on that. Mauricio, DSM has a lot of experience working with the NGO community. What are some of the big challenges and the lessons learned?
I think that one of the major challenges is that there is a lot of knowledge in the public sector, there is a lot of knowledge in the private sector, and a lot of knowledge in the NGOs and governments. The major challenge is create a governance model who take all these parties together and find a way that looking into the most important target, that is tackling malnutrition, and making in a way that is really collaborative among the different parties and try to avoid that these parties have different objectives. So I think the NGOs play a very important role in creating this, number one, atmosphere to getting this collaboration done, but also enforcing a kind of governance model that facilitates implementation of the programs. And something that I always like to make very clear, plan less, act more. Because sometimes we expect to have all the details, all the commas solved in the paper. And the time that we spend in doing this, by the time that we are doing this, a lot of children around the world are suffering from malnutrition. So don't wait until we have a perfect solution. There is no perfect solution. The perfect solution is that is tackling the problem as soon as possible, because there is no time for us to wait. So please, act more and plan less.
I think that's a great note to end this first part of this session. So thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I know we're approaching the end of what's been a pretty long and intense day, but I want to ask those of you who are sitting at tables where you just have a couple people to engage in some mergers and acquisitions and join another table. We're going to ask you the same question that we've been asking you all along, which is given the challenges and opportunities that you've heard with respect to addressing maternal and child undernutrition, whether it's promoting early and exclusive breastfeeding or developing nutritionally dense complementary foods or fortifying staples. What are the most important things that you think that government, the private sector, and NGOs could take to reduce maternal and child undernutrition? So we're going to take some time for you to engage with that question, and then we're going to invite our panelists back on the stage to also address some of the questions that you've asked. So we'll be back in touch in about 20-25 minutes. Thank you.